my clothes neatly folded on the dresser. Even the cap on my toothpaste would be screwed back on, and my razor and comb lined up neatly on a folded face towel next to the sink. I'm not a messy person normally, but when I look back on that time at the Betsy, I can see that I let myself slip. I had lost control of everything. My wife's health, my boy, my business. And in this one space, this little New England motel room, the problems that existed could be fixed by someone else. That someone else was Lydia. I didn't meet her in those first 2 weeks, but I did feel her. In the moments before opening the door to that motel room, I would anticipate the clean room, the restored order, the lemon smell of wood polish, and in those days it was the only thing that gave me anything resembling relief. Robert was in a coma for 3 days. He aspirated his own vomit when he was unconscious, and they think he was oxygen-deprived for as long as 3 hours before the police discovered him in that barn. I sat by his bedside until he came out of it. I know it may sound perverse, but a part of me misses those hours with my son. My role, what I could do for him, had never been so clear. I had to be near him. I told him about his sisters and his mother, our dogs, and the ugly house being built across the street in the woods where he used to play. I held his hand, which was something I'd never before done and have not done since. I wonder sometimes if it's like this with other fathers. What I know is that for me, having a son has been a difficult riddle, an awkward tiptoe between too tough and too easy. I never got the hang of it. Not like with my daughters, who were uncomplicated to be around, to love. The rules of engagement were much more obvious. Robert never liked sports. I think sometimes it was because when he was very young, I was too busy with work and Kay and the girls to put a basketball in his hands and get him on the court. He liked his elaborate fantasy world of Dungeons and Dragons and the books he made, and he liked Tim, but he didn't have any interest in anything I knew about. When Kay was alive, she'd tell me it wasn't his job to be interested in me. It was my job to be interested in him. If she was right, and I expect she was, I failed at the job miserably. By the time he left for Harkness, I had convinced myself that Robert was better off without my meddling, that he was self-sufficient and would navigate the world of boarding school and college just fine without knowing how to play basketball, or a father who knew his way around the castles in Dungeons and Dragons. I can see now how self-serving that was. After he came out of the coma, Robert remained in the ICU for 9 days. He was conscious but vacant, and his speech was impaired. I sat with him like those first 3 days, but I did not hold his hand. Of all the things to remember, it's hesitating with my hand that morning when he was newly awake and frightened, stumbling with the simplest words. That is a moment I would do differently if I had the chance. There are many. What could I have possibly been worried about? Everything is the answer. I was worried about everything. It's painful to admit, but when I remember that time, I see myself as a skittish fool, wringing my hands over every little decision and getting most of them wrong. Why is it only later that things begin to make sense? Mostly, I've made my peace with the mistakes I've made, but every so often I bump into a memory and it will sit me right down. Not swarming my boy with attention and love in those early years. Not grabbing his hand and pulling him toward me as much as I could have. Letting him disappear to boarding school because it felt at the time like one less thing to worry about. These are the regrets that slip and drop down. And when they do, there is nothing to be done. No action I can take to make it better. I just let them come for as long as they will. After his time in the ICU, Robert was moved to the hospital's acute rehab unit to try to get him walking, talking, and problem-solving again. There was brain damage, but with work, the doctors assured me it was likely he'd be fully functional, both physically and cognitively. They worked with him for nearly a month, and in that time I flew home for a night or two, but for the most part stayed at the motel and saw Robert for breakfast and at the end of each day for dinner. The doctors wanted him to focus on the various therapies during the day, so I stayed away, worked from the motel room and spoke with Kay and my mother and sister, who were driving her to chemo and helping with the girls. Kay would ask about Robert, but deflected any questions I asked about how she was feeling. She tried to be cheerful, but I could hear her fading away a bit more every time we spoke. I met Lydia the day Robert was moved to the rehab unit, and his doctor asked that I come back at the end of the day. For the first time since I'd checked in, I'd returned to the motel before nightfall. I could hear the vacuum cleaner going as I put the key in the door, and for a second I hesitated before opening. I wasn't sure I actually wanted to see who performed the daily magic of tidying the room and arranging my things so carefully. I enjoyed and imagined into the mystery, so before I turned the key in the lock, I stopped and listened to the hum of the vacuum, the sound of its being pushed along the floor and bumping gently into furniture. I must not have noticed it turn off because without warning, the door opened, and suddenly there she was. In jeans and clinging white t-shirt, a pile of brown hair knotted loosely on her head, at least 10 years younger than I was. Young, beautiful, Lydia. She rushed off that first day, and neither of us said more than awkward hellos. I came back the following morning after an early breakfast with Robert, and she had not yet arrived. For some reason, I felt nervous. I began cleaning up the room and folding my clothes, which was what I ought to have done from the beginning. Her job was to clean the rooms, not pick up after the guests. I stopped short of making the bed, and instead made sure the toilet was flushed, and I tidied a pile of hospital paperwork scattered on the desk. She turned up before noon and didn't bother with knocking. I suppose it hadn't occurred to her I'd be there, so she just used her key and came right on in. I was sitting in the chair by the bed and remained silent as she set her large plastic bucket with cleaning supplies down on the carpet inside the door. She was wearing the same jeans as the day before, and again a t-shirt, but this time light blue instead of white. I said good morning, and she screamed. What happened over the next 3 weeks is not something I'm proud of, but it is not a regret, not like so much else is. Lydia Morey was a sad young woman trapped in a bad marriage, and I was a frightened man who knew his wife would soon be dead. There was more. She was sexy, young, healthy, and underneath those tight jeans and t-shirts, she had the curvy figure of a pinup. And though she was troubled, she was also tough in ways that let me know she'd be okay, that she'd figure out her life somehow and survive. I hope she did. Mostly, we just talked. She told me about the father she did not know, her mother's sharp tongue, and how she bullied her to stay with her husband despite his teasing and his violence. She talked about wanting to run away, driving to some town in the Middle West somewhere where no one knew her and where she could begin again. It was surprising and sad to see someone so young feel so hopeless. I listened, but I offered no solutions, no advice. How could I? My life was in tatters, and I hadn't a clue what to do. She listened to me tell my tale of woe, and we were able to laugh at it all, even the overdose, even the cancer. Our lives felt unreal and far away while we were in that motel room, as if we were telling stories of other people's lives to each other, not our own. Maybe it's what we both needed then. I don't know. What I do know is that it didn't feel bad or wrong. I'd never been unfaithful to Kay in the 18 years of our marriage. Never been seriously tempted either. But before I left the Betsy, 2 days before I returned to Atlanta, I went to bed with Lydia. It started when she kissed me, first on my forehead and then on my lips. We had been sitting on the bed and there had been a long silence. I had just told her I was taking Robert back to Atlanta to a hospital where he could continue his therapy. There was nothing to say. We both knew I would never come back to Wells, Connecticut, and to the Betsy. Our days together were about to be over. So she kissed me, and I kissed her back. To this day, I remember those hours with Lydia Morey as some of the sweetest and most desperate of my life. I wonder if she remembers them at all. June. There are barely any clothes in Lolly's bag. One bathing suit, one sundress, panties, flip-flops, flats, two t-shirts, and a pair of men's pajamas stolen from Adam years ago. There are more vitamin bottles and notebooks than garments. The man who reintroduced himself as Brody had walked her back to the car and drove her to a Super 8 motel less than a mile down the road. When she said she had no ID, he checked her in with his credit card and driver's license. He carried Lolly's duffel bag into the room, scribbled his number down, and told June he'd take the Subaru to his friend's garage nearby to put on a real tire and check the rest. He'd return it in the morning. Right away, she collapsed, curled under the sheets, the first she'd felt for more than a week, and slept until morning. She was awake when Brody came by to give her the car keys. She'd already been to the ATM in the lobby to get him money for the tire and the motel room. It was only $200, the maximum she could withdraw. When he pushed it away, she folded the bills and slipped them into his jeans pocket. "You got more than you expected when I asked you for help," she said. More words than she'd spoken in weeks. "I'm glad I was the one you asked," he replied, the first wrinkle of flirtation in his voice. Once he is gone, she sits on the bed next to Lolly's duffel, which she has filled again, but not before folding and arranging each item carefully. She keeps the notebooks on the bed and sits next to them before pulling one to her lap. There are three, each with the same orange cover Lolly preferred since high school. And just as they had been then, the notebooks are bursting with folded papers, poems ripped from the pages of the New Yorker, illegible memos from the photo editor she's been assisting at the fashion magazine where she started as an intern, crushed receipts, a Metro card, takeout menus from the city, bills, pages torn from gallery catalogs. Lolly had always used these beat-up old notebooks as a kind of portable file cabinet for her life, but there was no order, no system. The one June holds was nearest the top of the duffel, beneath the light blue towel exploding with vitamin bottles. The cover is unmarked. She opens it, lightly brushes the pages with her fingertips. She remembers cataloging unfinished canvases by a painter she once represented who committed suicide. His family asked her to go through his apartment and studio and organize whatever she felt was important. She remembers finding an old Boy Scout manual filled with precise pencil drawings of animals, bears mostly, some gentle koalas and black bear cubs, others angry with teeth exposed and claws out. Very likely no one had ever seen these drawings, and she remembers having the fleeting instinct to steal the book and keep it herself. Something about it was so private and beautiful, so hopeful, even given the situation that would cause her to find it. She did not steal it, but instead included it in a show at the gallery in New York and sold it to one of the artist's longtime collectors. It was one of the last shows she'd organized in New York before leaving for London. On the first three pages of Lolly's notebook are floor plans of imaginary houses, each with one bedroom, several large public spaces, and two rooms labeled Lolly's Studio and Will's Study. Studio for what, June wonders. Lolly had dabbled in pastel drawings and watercolor painting early in high school, but June hadn't heard her mention any of that since. The pages that follow are filled with half-written poems, incomplete to-do lists, seating plans for the wedding reception. There are pages of sample menus from Feast of Reason that Lolly kept asking Rick to revise and reimagine. There are pictures of wedding cakes and flowers pulled from magazines, and there are late bill notices from Con Ed for Lolly and Will's apartment in the city. Lolly's electric bill, the unpaid caterer. This is the first time these neglected responsibilities have occurred to June. A bolt of panic, a feeling of having to take care of things, returns. It is an old, familiar feeling from another life. The one phone call she'd made was to Paul, her lawyer in the city, asking what she needed to do to give him power of attorney over everything. The insurance claims, the bank accounts, outstanding bills. She asked him to consolidate her bank accounts, liquidate her 401k, pay whatever penalties needed to be paid, sell the property where the house had been, if it could be sold, and transfer any money she had to her checking account so that she could access it through her debit card. Paul drove to Connecticut with the papers to be signed and brought someone from his office to notarize them. June told him on the phone that she did not want a discussion or to be advised, just this one thing done, and he could take what she owed him from the account he now controlled. She hoped Rick, and anyone else she owed money to, had found their way to Paul by now. June begins to make a mental list of who these people might be. Rick, Lolly's landlord in the city, Edith Tobin, the town tax collector. The names buzz like bees. She closes the first notebook and pulls another from the duffel bag. This one has Lolly's name written across the front and underneath it a date, It's a sloppy date from 2 years ago. Summer 2012, which would have been when Lolly returned from her semester in Mexico City, when she brought Will to Boston to meet Adam, and then after to meet June. The meeting was brief, dinner in New York. This was before Lolly would agree to meet Luke, so June went to the city alone and drove back the same night. She barely remembers Will. Lolly brought many boyfriends around over the years, so there was no reason to expect this one would be any different. Also, she hadn't seen Lolly since Christmas. She'd asked both Adam and June not to visit her in Mexico City, to give her a break, she had explained, from being their daughter. June flips through the notebook and sees line drawings of Will. Page after page of profiles, details, his nose, his eyes, his collarbone. They are amateurish, but what strikes her is how detailed they are, how attentive. Lolly was always a bit hyper and distractible, as the bulging contents of her notebooks attested, but she'd obviously been paying close attention to Will. The sustained gaze required to create these drawings is patient, tender, intimate, and June struggles not to look away. She feels a sting of jealousy as she looks at a study of Will's wavy brown hair from behind. It is by far the most delicate and intricately drawn. June flips past the images of Will and finds a page covered in dark blue ink. At first it appears like a densely scribbled doodle, a nonsensical mural of shapes and lines. But when she turns the notebook on its side, it becomes clear that Lolly had been trying to create an image of the ocean. Crudely sketched seabirds fly at odd angles in the 2-inch gap between the jagged horizon line and the edge of the page. And beneath the birds rise elaborately drawn waves, within which June can make out the shapes of faces, hands, city buildings, a car, a plane, eyes, trees, a door. The effect is mesmerizing, and she begins to feel dizzy. June gently shuts the notebook and puts it on the bed, folded papers and clippings jutting from its edges. Here, she recognizes, is a new regret. What she saw in the images of Will, and even more clearly in the waves, was someone attempting to make sense of the world by recreating it, refracting and complicating its pieces in order to make meaning. What she saw was that Lolly was something she never imagined her to be. An artist. Maybe not a great one, if great could even be designated with empirical accuracy, but someone with an artistic soul who needed to abstract what puzzled her to find the answers. And June missed it. It didn't matter that she'd spent her career identifying and nurturing this very instinct in her clients. It didn't matter that this was the one part of her life where she had not failed. Lolly was an artist finding her way, and June missed it completely. She didn't know which was worse, that she missed it, or that Lolly never shared it with her. The dizziness gets worse, and June places both hands on the bed and steadies herself. She sits very still, her eyes closed, and both feet planted firmly on the floor. She waits for it to subside, which, after a few minutes, it does. Eventually, she forces herself to pull the last notebook from the duffel. When she opens this one, she sees nothing is sketched or written on its pages, nothing stuck inside. It is new, its spine uncracked, and its pages blank. She closes the notebook and sees, written on its cover in brown marker, Greece. June puts the notebook on the bed next to the other two and lies down. Her limbs feel leaden, numb. Her mind dulls. She slept for more than 12 hours the night before, but is suddenly again tired. Moving slowly, she pulls her knees to her chest and closes her eyes. There is a loud knock on the door. She has no idea how much time has passed. She notices that while asleep, she has pushed the notebooks off the bed, and much of the wrinkled and folded contents have slid out across the thinly carpeted floor. "Hello? Hello in there? Checkout was 2 hours ago." She blinks her eyes to understand where she is. "Okay, okay," she calls, not knowing to whom or why. She looks at her feet and sees one of the notebooks face up, open to a drawing she hadn't seen earlier. It's of a one-story beach motel, scribbled in blue ink, with a sign in front that spells, "The Moonstone." In front, there is an awkwardly sketched office and a row of cars. Behind the building is scrawled a greatly exaggerated depiction of crashing surf, spraying sea and foam to the top of the page. June picks the notebook up from the floor, places it in her lap, and flips to the next page. Written in blue ink, dated July 7th, 2012, is a letter. The first word is, Mom. Lydia. She's warm, feels her skin getting damp under her clothes. So mid-stride, without slowing, she takes off her fleece pullover and folds it across her left arm. She's walking quickly. The cool air against her neck feels good. She breathes in deeply and wipes the sweat from her forehead. She remembers the money and double-checks the pocket to make sure it hasn't fallen out. $700 and the change from the 50 she used to pay for her coffee at the coffee shop. She can't believe the amount, or that she drove to the Walmart in Torrington to get the cash card Winton asked for and then mailed it away. Thank God, she thinks, it came back to her. She has enough money to live on from Luke's insurance and selling his business, but only if she lives cheaply, as she does. She squeezes the wad of bills in her pocket and thinks with a pulse of relief. Winton said they'd refund the lottery tax, and they did. She starts to let herself imagine the whole ridiculous scheme is real. It's not so much the money that excites her as the possibility that Winton is telling the truth, that he's the friend he's sold himself to be. But so much of what he says does not add up. Is the refunded tax money just a way to get her to trust him? Set her up for a bigger haul? Winton did mention a handling charge a few phone calls before, but said not to worry about it now, that it would be nothing compared to her windfall. She runs through the dozens of inconsistencies in his stories. When she challenged him once on the name of his ex-girlfriend, which changed nearly every time he mentioned her, he said, "Oh, Miss Lydia, I am not supposed to be getting so personal with you. I color some of the details to keep some privacy and protect you if my bosses ever found out we got to know each other as well as we have." This was only a few nights ago, when the money had not yet arrived and she was beginning to worry. "We must be on each other's side, my friend, for us to get through this maze, for you to get your money and for me to leave this job." "Can we be on each other's side?" he asked. And she answered after a short silence, "We can." Maybe he is exactly who he says he is, Lydia thinks as she quickens her step. Maybe he's not the enemy. When has she ever been right about anyone? She was wrong about Earl and Rex and most men in between. And she was wrong about June. She remembers how at first she was sure the woman did not mean her or her son well. She could not fathom what this pampered New Yorker with a blonde ponytail and perfectly manicured nails could want from her. And she had no interest in understanding what she wanted from her son. She remembers telling her to go away, to leave both of them alone. She had judged her before knowing anything about her. Had she also judged Winton too harshly? Might he actually be on her side? After all, he'd spent nearly 3 months talking on the phone to her. His stories kept changing, but he kept telling them, kept calling each morning and each night. He did not go away, she reminds herself as she passes Edith Tobin's flower shop, which is more than she can say for June. It is dark now, and someone is behind her. She's heard footfalls, but does not want to stop, does not want to turn around. She is only 6 or 7 driveways away from her apartment building. Her forehead beads with sweat and she can feel her jeans sticking to her legs. She holds her fleece with both hands against her chest. Only 5 driveways now. She hears a shoe scrape the sidewalk and something, a stick, a pebble, knocks against her calf. Someone is behind her. She stops, spins around, and before she sees who is there, explodes. "Get away from me!" Standing less than a foot from her is a boy wearing a green hooded sweatshirt. Up close, she is certain this is Kathleen Riley's son. Same green eyes, same thin lips. He looks directly at and then beyond Lydia, just over her shoulder. He begins to say something. I know you, but stops and rushes past her down the sidewalk toward the end of Upper Main Street and out of sight. Lydia's blood is racing, and she struggles to control her breathing. She checks the money in her fleece pocket and is relieved to feel it still there. She hurries the short distance to her building and fumbles with the key. Her hands are shaking. As soon as she gets the door open and closes it behind her, there is immediately a loud slamming on the window pane. Bam! 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 The boy, she thinks, he's followed her home. She pushes the full weight of her body against the door as she scrambles to lock the deadbolt. Stop! Stop this! She screams, her hands slick with sweat, the adrenaline streaking through her body like lightning. What do you want from me? Her knees have buckled at the door. She cannot stand. As in nightmares from her childhood, she has lost the power to move. The slamming returns, and she crawls awkwardly away from the door. But when she gets enough distance to look back, she sees it is not the boy. It is a woman with a baby strapped in front of her in some kind of cloth carrier. Lydia closes her eyes and breathes. She calls out to the woman to hold on a second, and manages to stand and walk into the kitchen to towel the perspiration from her face. Once her breathing steadies and her heart calms, she unlocks the door. I'm so sorry, she explains. I thought you were someone else. But the woman is unmoved. She is young, with tanned skin, short dark hair, and deep lines around her mouth and eyes. Once the door fully opens, she steps forward and with her free hand strikes Lydia hard across her right cheek. That's for my father, she yells. She pulls her arm back to strike again, but hesitates and steps back outside the apartment door. She looks as nervous as she is angry. Whoever you are, if you don't give me the money my father sent you, I will call the police and have you arrested. And don't deny it. I know who you are, and I know from the address those monsters in Jamaica gave him that you're the one he sent the money to. You people are destroying him. He's an old, lonely man, and it's disgusting that you'd prey on an easy target like him. He actually believes there are millions of dollars with his name on it somewhere. He actually believes you people are his champions. Stunned, Lydia reaches into her pocket, her fingers shaking, her mind still processing what she's just heard. Whoever this woman's father is must have fallen for Winton's scam, too, she thinks, handing the woman the $700 bills along with the loose pile of 20s, 5s, and 1s. He must have believed, as she had, that he was paying the tax to advance closer to the big prize. And this woman, his daughter, has mistaken her to be part of the con and not just like him. An easy target, lonely, someone willing to believe lies and throw money away in order to not be alone. The woman leans in, snatches the money from Lydia's hand, and tucks it into the pockets of her white corduroy trousers. The baby, who has until now remained silent, begins to cry. Whether it is a boy or a girl, Lydia cannot tell, but the crying becomes screaming, urgent, high-pitched screaming, as if someone has pinched the infant's skin. Tiny hands, red and desperate, reach up from the swaddle of pale yellow cloth bundled against the woman's chest. You need to stop what you're doing, she says seriously, oblivious to the exploding child. She holds Lydia's gaze for one more beat, and as she pulls the door shut behind her, says seriously, you need to stop. The silence that follows is complete. There are no sounds in the apartment, no cars driving past, or people hollering anywhere. Lydia stands next to the door, locks it, and leans against the wall. The phone rings and she lets it. It stops for a few minutes and then begins again, and the pattern goes on for over an hour. Finally, she crosses the living room into the kitchen and waits. After a minute, the phone rings again and she picks up. It is, of course, Winton. He speaks her name once and then again, but she says nothing. She is not playing games or holding back. She has no words. The boy on the sidewalk, the slap, the screaming child. She has been shocked into silence. Winton speaks again. Lydia, come back to Earth. Come back down here to Mother Earth. She's heard these words before. Who else said this to her? Rex. The last man she called a boyfriend. Come back to Earth, space cadet, he used to say. Touchdown, Spacey. Who else but Rex? She can still feel the sting from the woman's slap on her cheek, and something her mother used to say to her bubbles up. One of these days, someone is going to knock some sense into you. It is not a happy memory. Her mother would only ever say it when she was angry or drunk. But something about it makes Lydia laugh. She pictures her mother at that kitchen table, wagging her finger, drinking her schnapps, barking her warnings. She cannot help but laugh. Lydia, are you somewhere there? Winton. She forgot for a moment he was on the other end of the line. My dear Lydia, he says. My dear, what is wrong? She hears his concerned tone, the extra careful wording, but it does not soothe her. He continues to say her name, asks what could possibly be the matter. That voice, she thinks, and laughs again. I have sent money in the mail to someone I do not know, and I have been attacked in my own home. For a voice, a stranger's voice. Tell me what troubles you, the voice coos. Tell me. Again, she thinks of Rex, the last man who lied to her as much as Winton has, she thinks. The last man like him who had the power to make her do things she knew were wrong. Again, she is quiet. After a long silence, Winton says again and gently, tell me what's wrong. Do you really want to know? She asks, feeling against her will, the desire to tell him about her crazy evening. She holds the receiver to her ear and recognizes that besides Winton, there is no one she can tell about the boy following her home, the furious woman slapping her face, anything. She leans forward and drops the receiver to her lap. The voice in her hands is all she has, and it's nothing. She rocks gently and wishes she could vanish. She feels more alone now than in the weeks after Luke's death. After a while, she hears Winton's voice coming from the phone. She puts the receiver to her ear and hears him chanting to himself, almost singing. Oh, Miss Lydia, where have you gone? What have you done and where are you? Come back to me, miss. I'm here, she whispers. I never went anywhere. I'm right where I've always been. Winton's voice falls to a whisper. Tell me a story, my dear Lydia. Take a load off your soul. Tell me the truth because it will set you free. Lydia hears the creak of footsteps in the apartment above her. She listens to her upstairs neighbor walk across the kitchen, open the refrigerator door, and shut it softly. She hears the pop of a beer bottle opening and the clack of the tossed cap in the sink. She sits up straight, her back against the wooden chair. When she speaks, her voice scratches in her throat. I'll tell you a story, Winton, the one about where I've always been. Lolly. Mom, I'm writing to you from the edge of the world. It truly feels like we are in some place between Earth and Heaven here on the beach in Moclips. We checked in 2 nights ago after driving for 4 straight days from New York. Can you believe we got pulled over in New Jersey on Route 3? Right out of the gate, bam, $125 speeding ticket. I'm sure the cops saw Will's Washington State plates and said, let's get him. Anyway, we thought it was a bad omen for our trip, but instead it turned out that every moment after has been charmed, like we've had a lucky star guiding us the whole way. Even when we got lost in Pennsylvania, it led us to stay in the most beautiful little town that's almost exclusively Amish. They couldn't have been nicer. We'd heard about a group of teenagers who'd flipped their car. Amish kids getting drunk and living it up in their purgatory year between high school and marriage. The whole town seemed to be shaped around those dead kids. Like if you looked closely, you could see each one in the places where they once were. It's strange to say, but I feel like I know them a little. There was so much talk of them. That town was so sad, but it was also beautiful to see a community need each other so much. And their faith. I have never believed in God, though I can see how believing in one would help in the aftermath of the kind of tragedy they'd been through. You can't imagine how many stars fill the sky here. They are brighter than the moon. Or the sound of the wind and the crashing waves, like freight trains outside the window. It's not frightening because for some reason this simple room at the edge of the world feels like the safest place I've ever been. I know I'm rambling, Mom, but I'm in a mood, as Dad would say. Crossing this country, ending up here where Will grew up, I now understand why it was so important to him to show me. And the crazy wind has me thinking. It's funny to think that the wind has a shape, but it does. It becomes visible every once in a while, in rain being driven to the ground in sheets, or in the snow on the fields behind our house. I remember looking out the window of my room in the winter, watching the wind blow on the surface of the white fields, lifting and whipping the snow into spirals, and in a flash you could see the force that was always there come to life and reveal itself. I think it is this way with children and parents. They are always there, and then suddenly, through some shock, or disappointment, or great gesture, or absence, the child sees this person who was there all the while, invisible to them beyond their function to provide. This is how it's been for me with you. I only really saw you once you left Daddy, and I didn't like what I saw. I couldn't understand why you would leave him after all those years together, how you could choose your career over both of us. I still don't understand, if I'm really being honest. But it's only lately that I can see that what I can and can't see doesn't matter. I don't have the right to say who you were with or not, and it is not my right to know. With Luke in your life now, you have really snapped into view as a woman, like me, with the full menu of wants and desires as the rest of us. I'm not saying this has been much fun or not embarrassing. I'm ashamed to say that it's both. But it has shaken things up. I'm sorry I refused to meet him in New York. I didn't want him to overshadow Will. And if I'm honest about it, I think I was worried how I would react, and I didn't want Will to see me out of control. Speaking of control, I guess Dad has come into view more too. I've known for a long time about his desperate womanizing. It's always made me sad, but it's something I never held him accountable for. I blamed it on you, as I have many things. It never occurred to me until recently that maybe his childish way with women preceded your leaving, and that it most likely had a lot to do with it. I can't believe this never really occurred to me before. I also can't claim to have come to some of these ideas on my own. Early on, with Will, he told me that it would be a good idea to question everything I thought I knew about Dad, you, your marriage, my childhood, myself even. Actually, he suggested that whenever I was resistant to a differing opinion about anything, I should try this out. Here I think he was talking about politics, him being much more sympathetic to our president than I am. Still, it's been difficult to pull back the curtain on old stories and old opinions. I've been doing it for a while now, and it's humbling to see things more as they were and less as I have felt them to be over the years. What I'm trying to say is that I've been punishing you for a long time for not making the choices I wanted you to make. And as Will snores next to me now, and before the sun comes up in a few hours, I just want you to know that I see things a little more clearly now, and I hope you can forgive me for being unable to sooner. I still get furious when I think of how you left and the way you made all these decisions without including me. You just announced the new order of things as if none of it had anything to do with me. Can you possibly imagine how that felt at 14? Or how lonely it was after you left? Did you even think about me when you made all these decisions? Did you ever think how much I would miss you? Oh, here I go. It takes so little to go back to all that. But I suppose that's why I'm writing to you now. To be completely honest, it's something Will suggested I do. To write to you without worrying about you reading the words. To just say what I feel without risking being held to any of it. He told me to do this months ago, but every time I tried, I couldn't. But tonight feels different. Something about this place and Will. I want with you what he has with his parents. It's so uncomplicated with him. He just loves them, and it's so easy and affectionate between them. I want that, but I don't know how to get it. It's like if I just let you off the hook for everything, I've betrayed myself, or the self I was, and that's when I get stuck. But as Will and I move ahead together, I'm feeling like it's getting easier to let go of some of the stuff I've been hanging on to. What I want to say is that I don't want to go back to or stay stuck in the way things have been between us. Everything seems so delicate and brief, and I don't want us to be so apart anymore. I don't know how to say any of this to you, which is why I'm writing it down. I hope I give you this someday. Love, Lolly. Silas. He is pedaling as fast as he can out of town and toward home. He cannot shake the frightened look on her face, her voice yelling. He has imagined them meeting many times, but never once the way it went tonight. When he's pictured it, she is warm, comforting, tucking him into her large bosom and stroking his head. He has imagined her without her clothes, kissing his chest, holding his dick. He has imagined her cutting his dick off, too, to punish him and throwing it in Indian Pond. He has imagined Lydia Maury every which way, but never how he saw her tonight. She was terrified, and maybe in one of his fantasies it would have turned him on, but this time it did just the opposite. It rattled him, exposed her beyond the limited versions of her he'd been working with. This was not lonely or angry or lusty or grieving. This was human, and it's much more than he can handle. He turns off Tate Lane down a dirt road. Once he's out of sight of passing cars, he jumps off his bike and lets it crash to the ground. He unhooks the knapsack from his shoulders, the yellow canvas hardly visible. He cannot see his hands or fingers clearly, but he knows the surfaces and shapes of his stuff. Tupperware container, bowl, water bottle, bong, and lighter. He sloppily packs an untidy hit and lights it. He smokes it down and quickly packs and lights a second. The pot is a mix of some old stuff from Charlie and a few new buds he stole from a neighbor who hides his plants in plain sight along the back row of his vegetable garden. It's a strong blend, and soon he feels a thick film rise between this moment and the last few hours. He regards it all now, dimly, as through a foggy snow globe, and for that he is grateful. He leans against a tree and sees Lydia's face again. He can now slow the incident down and watch her eyebrows rise, her mouth widen as she yells at him. She's covering her chest with her coat. But now that he's in charge of the scene, he has her drop it, and he looks down her low-scoop t-shirt as she bends to pick it up. Now the t-shirt is sweaty and soaked, and through the translucent cloth he sees pink skin, dark, wide nipples. The vision relaxes him, helps him shake off the feelings from before. He packs up his gear, zips the knapsack, and throws it over his shoulder. He walks his bike back to Tate Lane. Above him, the moon is nearly full and glows pink in the chilly night. Thin clouds inch slowly across the sky, and on the surface of the moon he begins to make out a face. At first, it is a rough mask with uneven eyebrows and lopsided whiskers, the mouth and nose disfigured and huge. Then it comes alive. He knows this face. It's the dragon he saw last May on his way home from June Reed's house. Back then, his ruby wings and infinite tail filled the sky, but now are invisible, cloaked in the blue-black night. Only the snout, the devil eyes, and the smoke pouring from its throat are visible. It's him. He knows he is hallucinating, but still, his hands shake as he pulls his bike toward him. As he gets on, he hears something. A voice, a growl, a barking dog. He cannot tell, but in that noise he hears, "Go!" as clear and precise as anything he has ever heard. He begins to pedal and looks up at the moon. The dragon's face is fully articulated, snout high, mouth wide. The eyes do not shift their gaze from him. He looks behind the moon and begins to see the outline of its mammoth body, the silhouette of its bat-like wings etching the sky. He is in the middle of the road, pedaling slowly and looking up and behind him at the same time. When he starts to trace the ridges on its epic tail, the handlebars twist in his hands, the front tire jerks to the left, and the bike collapses onto the pavement. As he falls, landing on his side, he hears a crack underneath him, the loose arrangement of bong and Tupperware breaking his fall, and then the bong, he can feel as well as hear, breaking to bits. He sits in the road, checks his limbs to see that everything still works. He feels along his side and shoulders to make sure none of the glass has speared him. He can detect no serious injuries, but he scraped the skin off his palms, and the exposed flesh begins to sting. Sitting in the middle of the road, he dares to look up, and sure enough, the dragon is beaming, amused, directly at him. "What the fuck? What?" he calls out, half crying from frustration and fear. "Go? Go where? Where am I supposed to go?" He is demanding answers from the enchanted arrangement of cloud and night and moon, but he knows where he has to go. He has not been back there since May, when he ran across the lawn and up the driveway to the road. "Fuck," he mumbles, pulling the bike from the road and wiping the loose asphalt from the cuts on his hands. He rides in the direction of home, but passes Wildy Road where he lives, and continues on Indian Pond. He refuses to look up at the night sky until he gets there, and as he passes the pond, he can see the pattern of blues and grays and blacks reflecting in the water. He cannot help but look, and the kaleidoscopic pattern shimmering there is both ominous and beautiful. Oncoming lights from up the road break the spell, and he slows his bike until the car passes. By the time it does, he is beyond the church, and soon he is at the top of the driveway. June. She knows now where this will end, where the land runs out and there is only sea, and between the two, a room. The pages of the letter are tucked into the orange notebook that sits on top of the other two in the passenger seat next to her. At the Super 8, she read each word, again and then again, until the manager demanded she leave immediately or pay for another night. The handwriting was familiar, undeniably Lolly's, but the words were not. They were from someone she only dimly remembered, from before she and Adam told Lolly they were divorcing. After that, Lolly was never as candid or open or as affectionate with June. She could see in the letter Lolly's conflicted attempt to describe a future she had yet to occupy. She never got there, June thinks, remembering the cold exchange with Luke on the porch the night before the wedding. But she was trying. Wherever she'd been by the time she died, it was much closer than June knew. To be given a glimpse now was a bitter miracle, a ghostly caress that left more regret than solace. As she crosses out of Idaho into Washington State, she breathes in Lolly's scent. She'd sniffed it earlier, wafting off the pages, faintly, the strange perfume that smelled like hot chocolate that Will gave her during their semester in Mexico, and continued to supply her with after. June rummaged through Lolly's bag, and found the small brown and white bottle, and sprayed her wrists lightly and the pages before folding them into the notebook and leaving the Super 8. The smell of cocoa and cinnamon fills the car. How could she have allowed so much distance between them? She hears Luke's voice, yelling, as if in answer. "Jesus, June, throw it!" He is running away from her in the lawn behind the house. "Throw it! Throw it!" He is shouting to her as she kneads the hard plastic rim of the frisbee in her hands. "What are you afraid of?" he calls, standing still now, arms crossed against his chest. It was the second summer, the one after he moved in, and he'd insisted they go outside and toss the frisbee. They'd made it as far as the lawn, but something in her refused to throw it. She can't remember what it was. The childishness of the game? That he had asked for something, demanded it, and she had the power to refuse? After a while, he walked off, chilly and disappointed. There were moments like this when she could not be what he wanted, and yet he would insist. It was like a game of chicken, and she always won. She never blinked, and as with the frisbee, he usually stormed off in a huff. Just like Lolly had so many times. She remembers how that yellow frisbee sat in the lawn for weeks, neither of them willing to retrieve it. Luke even mowed around the thing and let a little thicket of grass grow up in a rough circle where it lay. He never mentioned it, nor did she. And then one day it was gone. Her right hand strays from the steering wheel and rests on the notebook next to her. Her fingers brush the worn surface of the cover, and then she pulls it to her lap where she lets it rest. She breathes in Lolly's scent and relaxes her foot from the gas pedal. She is careful to maintain precisely the speed limit, as she does not want anything to stop her from getting to the Moonstone. If she stops for gas only, She will be there before evening. There is no reason to rush other than the feeling she's had since reading the letter, that she needs to see the inside of that room, hear the wind howl and the waves crash as Lolly described, see the same stars and moon, breathe the same salt air. It is not her daughter she is driving to, but it is as close as she will ever get. She is hours away. She will drive until the road runs out, and she will find that room, and she will stay. Dale. Our plan had been to wait a year before heading up from Portland to Moclips with Will's ashes, but after the first gentle day in February, when the cold rain slowed and the relief of spring was, if not actually near, imaginable, Mimi said it was time. I called the Moonstone and asked if room 6 was free the following weekend, and the woman who answered said it was not, and that likely it wouldn't be for a long while. Someone had checked in at the beginning of July and never left. I thought it was strange, since the Moonstone is hardly the kind of place you imagine someone calling home, but I was disappointed too, as room 6 meant something to Will. It was where he proposed to Lolly, and where he stayed when he returned to attend Joseph Chenoir's memorial. It would have been nice to stay in room 6, see what Will saw during those trips back to Moclips, but it wasn't the reason we were going. Will never told us where he wanted to be buried or have his ashes scattered. Why would he at 23 years old? But we knew. A stretch of beach, no longer than a mile, runs between the Moonstone and the Quinault Reservation, the ocean on one side and the small gray house where he grew up with us on the other. There was no place he loved more. No place he felt as safe. It was his home, and it gave us some comfort to think of him there. So for the first time since we'd lived there together as a family, we returned to Moclips. When we arrived at the Moonstone, the dusty black wagon parked by the dumpster looked like it hadn't been driven in years. The blue license plate below the back hatch was hardly visible, but we knew right away it was from Connecticut, and we knew it was June's. My first instinct was to stop the car, put it in reverse, and drive away. I felt like we had stumbled upon something too personal to barge in on. I assumed, since this was where Will and Lolly got engaged, she had come to be close to her daughter, just as we had come to be close to our son. Unsure what to do, we parked the car next to the office and sat silently for a long time. Eventually, Mike and Prue said we were being ridiculous, and that maybe it wasn't even June's wagon. So we went into the office, met the new owners, and got keys to two rooms, rooms 5 and 7, the only two left and, of course, on either side of room 6. None of us mentioned to Rebecca and Kelly that we knew June, not even when Kelly apologized again about room 6 not being available. We didn't decide on this in the car or even signal non-verbally to each other in the office. It was just something we all understood. If she was there, we'd leave her alone as best we could, though given the steps she'd taken to avoid us and everyone else, it was hard to imagine she'd stay once she knew we'd arrived. I don't know why or how, but through all these months of June's not returning our phone calls or responding to the letters we mailed to her care of her lawyer in New York, I knew she was okay. Mimi had wondered if we shouldn't make a greater effort to locate her, call the artist she'd represented, interrogate the lawyer, track down relatives, though there was never any mention of uncles or aunts or cousins. A few weeks after Christmas, I called information and asked for Lydia Morey's phone number and got it right away. I didn't know who else to call, and at first, maybe because of the speculation that her son, Luke, may have had something to do with the accident, I'd put it off. But she was the only person from that town we knew who might know where June was. Besides Luke, June was not a terribly connected person. She had no friends who we knew to be close to her. She had left her job at a gallery in London years before, and whatever work life she had was, to us, invisible. By the number of people who'd turned up at the church that morning and by the pictures on June's bookshelves and walls, it appeared she had lived a full and peopled life, but it didn't seem like anyone, besides Luke, had stuck, including, unfortunately, her daughter, who, according to Will and from what we could see ourselves, mostly stayed away. Given this, it's maybe not so surprising that Lolly clung to our family. Will often joked that she'd settled on him only so she could get to us. And it's true, I did notice how she would sometimes watch Will with Mimi or with Prue and Mike. She would watch them like her nose was pressed to the glass wall of an aquarium, watching exotic fish move in water, or how a scientist would observe rare bats in the wild. She said to us when we first met her in Mexico City that her parents didn't know how to do it. And when we asked her what, she said, "Everything." It was sad to hear a child speak so frankly and judgmentally about her parents. And for a while, Mimi worried that Lolly was too cynical, too tough-minded and negative for Will. I worried too, but Will was clearly in love, and I knew that nothing could be done if someone felt that way about another person, especially your child. Lolly was different, certainly on the self-centered and selfish side, but she was at her core kind, and she adored Will, and we could do nothing, so we embraced her. I think Will sensed that despite her girlish manner, something was broken in her. Mimi says wounds can sing a beguiling song, and for Will, who from boyhood felt compelled to fix and help and take care of nearly everything and anyone in his path, Lolly's song was irresistible. Outside the subject of her family, Lolly was lighter and more open, so we tended not to bring them up. So when we finally met Adam, and later June and Luke, we knew little about any of them. Mimi and I had pieced together that relations were difficult between June and Adam. He had various girlfriends whom Lolly didn't respect, and once June began her relationship with Luke, Lolly at first refused to acknowledge him and for the most part avoided her mother. She talked to Prue about it the week before the wedding, and of course Will, but I don't really know what went on between Lolly and her mother. Clearly they had much to resolve, and according to Prue, among the many sad things about what happened is that they had, in those months leading up to the wedding, just begun. When I spoke to Lydia in January, she told me June had been gone since early summer, and that she had not seen or heard from her since the funeral. She said that what remained of the house had been demolished, and a chain now blocked the driveway from the road. She reported the news dispassionately, as if she had little to do with any of it, or with June, which surprised me since the two of them, from what I could see in those few days before the wedding, seemed close. At the rehearsal, June fixed Lydia's hair, and both of them laughed, secretively, like old friends. I can still picture them, side by side, talking in the church, on the lawn, at the sink, on the porch. I remember them more with each other than apart. They were a funny pair, very different in superficial ways. One sleek and blonde, the other earthy with long dark hair falling down everywhere. One poised and stoic, the other needier, less sure. Still, they were much the same in how they approached their children, formal and timid, careful, as if they had only just met them. But with each other they appeared relaxed, natural. So to hear Lydia talk about June with such distance was a surprise. But then I remembered June at the funeral, and the days before. She didn't speak, not to us, not to Lydia, not to anyone. I remember how she pivoted away from each of us when addressed, and if hugged, she held still, hands at her sides, until it was over. We reached out to her as best we could, but we were in shock, and instinctively we closed ranks among ourselves. We were out of our minds and away from home. Our boy was gone. There had been rumors right away about Luke causing the explosion. The day we left Wells, the woman at the front desk at the Betsy told us she always knew something terrible was going to happen the moment she heard Lydia Hannafin's boy moved into June Reed's house. "Bound to end badly," she said, shaking her head and sounding perversely satisfied. The four of us stayed quiet and left the small lobby as quickly as possible. We chose to believe that what happened was a horrible accident, nothing more and nothing less. Anyone who had ever been in that kitchen knows it had to have been something to do with the stove. It looked like something from the Depression era, rusty and white, tilting at an angle. I remember the afternoon before the rehearsal, watching June fussing over one of the burners to boil water for tea, muttering when it wouldn't light right away. "If I blame anyone, it's June. She should have taken care to replace that treacherous appliance. It was so clearly not safe. She had the means, and the rest of the property was well maintained, meticulous even. I try not to think about it, but at times I catch myself wondering how on earth she could have missed this one thing. How could she have been so careless? Knowing that June must agonize over these same questions dulls with pity but does not eradicate the anger I can still feel. What was left of that old stove, the house, and